Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome to Brain Injury Radio Network. Tonight is our regular Wednesday installment of our program Recovery Now with your host, Kim Justice. If you'd like to know more about my story, you can find it at inaflash.org. I, too, am a fellow traumatic brain injury survivor. I appreciate you tuning in tonight, and as always, I look forward to your input. So now, we'll get on with the show. Well, hello, and happy hump night from somewhere in middle America. Hope you guys are enjoying the first couple of days of spring. Just before that, we were, and then the bell rang for the first day of spring, and it's 39 degrees, and we're having light snow and freezing drizzle. Go figure. I guess we're doing spring next week instead. But I want to welcome you all here tonight to the show. It's Brain Injury Awareness Month, as most of you know. Us survivors would tell you that every month is Brain Injury Awareness Month for us. But we appreciate this month, and I do particularly not only this month, but I've been here every week for going into my 12th year. And to raise awareness about brain injury, when I suffered mine in 1995, the traditional medical model knew very little. They knew how to save a life, but really knew nothing about the residuals that we walked away with for the rest of our life. And so I lived my life in a vacuum from 95 to 2012 when I started here. And it's been amazing to see the growth. It's never as fast as we would like it to be. But I think the last figures I looked at said 2.8 million people a year suffer a traumatic brain injury. And so far this month, we've talked about many different aspects of brain injury. And then last week, many of you listened because I got some phenomenal feedback on former professional boxer Ray Ciangolini and his book, Second Impact, his story. And tonight in the second portion, we're going to be having on Rico Petrini, who's a football player. And both of those people suffered from brain injury. And I've had many guests on my show before that have, and also military who have suffered from the concussive effects of blast injuries. And so we hear a lot about it, but we don't hear a lot of solutions. And tonight our first guest is someone who's working on those solutions, and I'm going to bring him on in just a moment. For those of you that are new around here, Recovery Now is a gathering place for anyone seeking recovery from the challenges of life on life's terms. Guests share their experience, strength, and hope. We discuss useful tools that have helped us lighten the load of our journey through recovery. More will be revealed. This is a We recovery program because it is in the We that we find the new me. We focus on the four A's of recovery: awareness, acceptance, action, and adaptation. This is a place for survivors striving to become thrivers, and for that, it takes a good bit of warrior. Again, I'm your host, Kim Justice, and I'm glad you're here. Our first guest tonight is Dr. Michael Wyand, and he is a biopharmaceutical executive with over 25 years' experience in managing and building successful product and service-oriented life science companies. He's the CEO and director of Oxia Biopharmaceuticals, a clinical stage biotech company developing new innovative therapeutics for mild traumatic brain injury known as concussion and related neurometabolic dysfunction. Oxia is actively recruiting participants for its ongoing trial of OXE-103 at the University of Kansas Medical Center. OXE-103 could advance treatment directly addressing the underlying pathology of TBI. An accomplished leader, Dr. Wyand, has substantial experience managing R&D and as a corporate officer. He trained in comparative pathology at Harvard Med School, received his DVM from Purdue University, and his PhD in pathology from the University of Connecticut. He received his BS in biology from the University of Connecticut, where he graduated with honors as a university scholar. With that, I'm going to bring him on and hear about this exciting new clinical trial, see if we can get this second part of the trial filled and find out about this new drug and bring it to market so it can start helping people. With that, I'm going to bring on Dr. Michael Wyand.
Hello,
welcome
Kim.
To the show, Michael. Thanks so much for coming on tonight.
No, I really appreciate the invitation. It's great to be able to talk to someone as passionate about traumatic brain injury as you are and to spread the word about all the different things that are going on. I'm very happy to be here.
Well, I'm really excited about the clinical trial. You know, I've talked with my guests before, and all of the athlete types, everyone but military, so athletes and civilians who came up when I did, when we were suspected of having a concussion, the advice was to not let us go to sleep or we might wake up dead. And
right.
That was it. That was the whole deal. And I mean, I'm old, but I'm not ancient. So, you know, things hadn't changed, and it wasn't that long ago that concussion got classified as a TBI on a relative scale from all the people that I talked to that have gotten that first advice I was telling you about. And so then it gets classified as a mild brain injury. I still hate that description because when you live it, it doesn't feel mild, but I get the mechanics. you can talk about that or not. I get the mechanics of it, but the clinical trial you're going to talk to us about tonight, I'm just very excited about, because what it appears we're finding out, and you're the doctor and the scientist, so I'm just going to start out maybe asking you, you don't have a memory problem, I do, so I think would like to know, have you tell the audience, I know that I just did in the bio, but a little bit of what got you interested in brain injury and coming down this road and getting involved in this subject and the clinical trial. So a little bit of backstory, if you will. And then, of course, I can read the audience OXE-103, but that doesn't mean anything to them. So when we get to where you got interested in brain injury, what was the impetus in making you pursue this clinical trial, these studies in the clinical trial, then you'll be explaining to us what that is and how it's supposed to work.
Sure. Yeah, so I started doing some brain research quite a long time ago when I did my residency in pathology and was at that time we were looking at the effects of HIV in the brain, and I did a lot of studies to look at the different infectious processes. And then I kind of got away from the brain and worked in a number of other areas in cancer and with cancer vaccines and pain products and so forth. My kids all played sports. My boys played football. One of my sons played college football. And, you know, I watched them play, and I was always more concerned about a catastrophic spinal injury or some other, you know, they would blow up the ligaments in their knee. You know, I was always worried about those types of injuries. And if I saw them, you know, saw them get hit in the field and they stood up, and they walked, and they seemed to have all their arms and legs functioning, then I tended to think, well, everything's okay. Because, you know, as you said earlier, those of us who grew up, you know, playing sports before there was any recognition of concussion, it just was something that you expected to tough out. So if
exactly.
You're playing a sport, you know, if you're playing a sport and you got knocked senseless and you could stand up and stay on the field, you know, your coach thought you were a hero, your teammates thought you were a hero, the fans thought you were the toughest guy in the place, and people would stand there and let you stay on the field. Where if you twisted your knee and you got carted off the field to go get an x-ray, everybody thought, well, that makes a lot of sense. You know, your knee, you got to really watch out for your knee. But, of course, your brain was something that, because I think it's encased inside your head, it's something that people just have a very difficult time seeing and understanding the degree of the injury that's occurred.
Right.
But nonetheless,
in recent times,
that has all changed. And, you know, when you described the recommendation that if you have had a head injury, that you would wake the person up every hour and ask them what day it was and what their birthday was, you know, throughout the night to make sure that they didn't fall asleep and then didn't wake up. You know, that was kind of a poor man's CT scan of the brain to make sure that there wasn't any internal bleeding or any other internal damage that was
mm-hmm.
going to lead to a more severe outcome. But times have changed, and I think the development of therapeutics, concussion, for mild TBI concussion, have really lagged behind attention and for several decades actually, the attention that was given to more severe forms of TBI. And a lot of the more severe forms of TBI, and I think one of the major reasons to distinguish between mild TBI and severe TBI is that, you know, the more severe forms of TBI usually have some other type of structural damage to the brain. You know, you've got a fractured skull, or you've got significant bleeding in the brain, or you might even have a penetrating injury that goes into the brain and, you know, damages the actual brain itself. So the mild TBI is kind of that rule-out injury where those structural injuries have not occurred. And you're left with a brain that really hasn't been penetrated, it hasn't been cut, it hasn't had large sections of it disrupted. But nonetheless, the shockwaves that go through the brain can, as we all know, cause significant dysfunction, I'll call it. And that dysfunction, if it persists, and certainly if it's a repetitive injury, like we see with, you know, military populations or with athletes, if it's repetitive, then we can start the accumulations of some of the changes and dysfunction that occur. And that can lead to some of these longer-term conditions that you mentioned with the other athletes, like CTE and Parkinson's disease and other types of dementia associated with the long-term effects of multiple injuries. So I think the mild area is a fascinating area.
I'm sorry. I think it's a fascinating area, too. I think a lot of people, you know, there's even some confusion there because some think that if you have a brain injury where you were knocked out, that's a more severe one, and that a mild one is somebody who didn't go into a coma or didn't lose consciousness. And I think that's why the mild term, and I joked that if, you know, people use that term, but not the people that are suffering from it, because it doesn't feel mild, you know, when you're the recipient suffering the symptoms of it. But, you know, going back for just a minute to that old treatment, and I thought that was interesting, the poor man's CAT scan, you know, that we're obviously we're going to be going on with the topic, but, you know, I was sitting in an emergency room with a brain bleed, an aneurysm that had ruptured. So my brain was bleeding, and they asked me those questions, my name and the questions you said, who's the president, what day is it? I answered those questions in a huge amount of distress, but I answered them. And they sent me home saying that I was having a muscle spasm in my neck. And within 12 hours, I was getting violently ill to the point it wouldn't stop. And before too long, I couldn't get my words out, but I could understand someone talking to me. And then within a very short time later, I was looking at them, watching their mouth move, and I couldn't comprehend anymore what they were saying. And then I went into a coma. But I was treated, misdiagnosed and treated 24 hours later because I could answer those questions when I was having a brain bleed right in front of their face. And so, you know, that really is a terrible way, in my opinion,
right.
If it's a concussion even, you know, it isn't going far enough. In my case, I think, you know, I would be pushing for more scans, and that would have helped me. But now coming back to you and our topic tonight, you know, with concussions, they really don't show up in a scan, and correct me if I'm wrong. Again, you're the doctor, but because I went on in 2015 then to fall, which is the number one cause, 45%, coming close to the largest percentage of how people get their TBIs, including concussion, mostly concussion in the falls. And, you know, it's interesting that there's not really an immediate tell, and that's why, you know, most of us call it the invisible, you know, the invisible injury, because it's, as you say, you're not limping off the field, you know, hurting your back, you haven't gotten knocked out, you haven't gotten slipped over and, you know, broke your neck, something like that. But I have had parents come on that exact scenario you gave about you and what you were looking for with your boys. I've actually had, parents come on the show and tell me that they saw their kid get up and were kind of staggering, you know, and a little punchy, you know, moving a little slower, whatever, than normal. We'll call it an uncharacteristic behavior than what they were used to seeing. And, you know, even then, because you can't see it, they saw something, and it was a tell, but they didn't know how to recognize it as a tell and thought it was just part of the game, part of the deal that you quote-unquote bell rung and didn't realize that was significant. Anyway, that's one of the things we're trying to get by on here is, you know, really, this is the invisible injury, except that sometimes there are some tells, and people really need to be educated about that. You know, if you see your kid playing ball and they're staggering around the field and seeming momentarily disoriented, walking the wrong direction on the field, you know, there's a lot of different things I've heard over the years. That's something you might want to go down and check, you know, check with your loved one about, because often we don't know, we don't realize on a conscious level the effects of that bell getting rung. You know, we're just kind of nodding our heads, and aren't as aware maybe as a coach would be or a parent would be or someone who is really paying attention to our movements. But that's just kind of a side note, and you go ahead and continue.
It's interesting because it's kind of the intersection of how we interact with our healthcare system and the types of injuries that increase in severity with different changes in the brain. So talking about the imaging and the brain and mild, so the mild injuries that we're studying in our trials are CAT scan negative. So someone who gets injured, whether they go to the emergency room or whether they go see their GP or whether they're on the sidelines with a trainer or whether they just don't do anything. They get injured and they rest at home with some, you know, somebody who's with them watching them or even alone. But those, there's no structural damage picked up by a CAT scan. There's this next classification is what we call complicated mild. And so those are people that have just a very tiny amount of hemorrhage that's detected in the brain. But it doesn't look like it's progressive, and it doesn't look like it's a large volume. Those people will also usually get observed maybe overnight in a hospital, but then be discharged. And then, of course, you get injuries where you have significant abnormalities on a CAT scan. Now, if you can imagine, the only way you're going to get a CAT scan is if you go to the emergency room. There might be some, you know, professional football teams that have CT scanners or imaging techniques within their, within their locker room, their stadium structures. But the only way you're going to get a thorough workup is if you do go to the emergency room. And we know that a lot of people, they don't go because they get injured. They are clearly dysfunctional. They don't know where they are. They can't, they may be nauseous. They can't walk straight. Their balance is gone.
Headaches.
They don't know where they are. But they'll sit them down the sidelines or wherever they've been injured. People sit them down and people observe them carefully to see if they're getting worse. If they're not getting worse, maybe they get a little bit better. Then there's a tendency many times not to engage the healthcare system. They may not see a doctor for days until their symptoms haven't resolved quickly, and they're having persistent symptoms that make them nervous. Then they go out, and the problem with the way concussions are dealt with today, which has a lot to do with the historical, what we talked about earlier, that the historical attitude was that, oh, you got your bell rung, you're going to be okay. What the problem they have is that now the patient who is injured and several days out now is not getting any better and decides to seek medical care, you know, where do they go? So because there are no treatments, because there are, you know, there are therapies that have to do with, you know, various exercise regimens, diet regimens, eye tracking, things like that. But there's no real pharmacologic treatment yet. We're working on it, obviously. And no clear treatment measurements for these folks. So they go to their general practitioner and they get some kind of treatment. They may not get better. They wait a while. The days go by, several weeks go by. And it usually takes them, you know, 2, 3, or 4 weeks before they will get even to a post-concussion clinic. And at that point, folks are starting syndrome. So, they finally got to a place that understands their injury, but it's a very convoluted way that we interact with the healthcare system after we get a concussion if we don't go to the emergency room. So that's
it. And I was one of those who went 3 weeks later. They diagnosed me with post-concussion syndrome, but they didn't. They just sent me away. There wasn't any treatment for it.
Right.
And if they gave me any instruction, because I was in post-concussion syndrome, I don't remember what they said. You know, I just know that they didn't send me for any therapy. They they did a history, and that's what they based. You know, I told them what happened, and told them my symptoms, and because of my prior bleed, you know, they did a CAT scan, and of course they didn't see anything, so they made the declaration it was post-concussion syndrome, okay, and sent me home, you know, and there was no drug to take. There wasn't any therapy they were going to prescribe. That was just it. You know, I came home with compounded residuals that I had the first time, so I'm in complete agreement as far as our healthcare system. You know, I'm shocked with as much brain injury as there is, and your Frank had sent me an article about last Wednesday, as a matter of fact, on Capitol Hill, the Brain Injury Awareness Day event. And one of the lines in the article says, while we know that brain injury is the leading cause of death and disability in our country, and then it goes on, and you'd think with a sentence like that, that there would be someone in the traditional medical model that would be able to recognize it or do something. But as a survivor and other ones, sports, military, they'll all tell you that we get the fast shuffle to the next doctor, to the next doctor, to the next doctor, and finally to a shrink. That seems to be the trump card at the end of traditional doctors when they've got no card to play, invariably send you to a shrink. And
yeah,
that isn't helpful. You know, I mean, for one thing, they probably put you on an antidepressant because the system, if you weren't depressed before you got in the system, once you get in the system, it's really depressing because nobody can help, you know, and there's no doctor managing your care and having a clear direction of where to go with this. And so you're largely managing it on your own at a time that you don't feel well, and nobody really seems to know what to do about it. And that's even today, you know, today, this isn't even back in your bell rung. That's how much we haven't progressed at this point, and why I was so glad to know what you're working on tonight.
Yeah, I think if we could develop some therapies, then doctors will have things to use, and then we'll start to see, much more capable management of someone with a concussion. You know, the concussion injury, what happens is you get either a direct blow to your head, or it can be an indirect blow to your body, which creates a whiplash type of an injury where your body stops short. We sometimes use the term deceleration injury. Your body stops quickly, your head bounces back and forth, and your brain inside your skull, goes back and forth and hits both sides of your skull. It creates the same type of lesion as if you got a direct hit to your head. But that direct hit to your head can cause all of the brain is basically an electrical organ that is got neurons, which are the cell bodies that are connected by wires, the axons. And when those chakras go through the brain, they cause all of those cells to fire. And it's not the type of injury that's localized necessarily to where you got hit, especially a concussion, because the chakras go through and they cause a depolarization event, a firing event across the entire brain. And that electrical discharge across the entire brain, you can think of it almost like a battery. It just drains the energy out of all the cells, almost instantaneously after the hit. And so then when the energy of the brain is completely discharged, there's dysfunction of the brain. So all the things you want your brain to do, thinking, walking, moving, everything that your brain's controlling is now not working properly. And frequently you'll see this sometimes in athletes in sporting events. When they get hit, they'll lie on the ground for a minute and shake, almost like they're having a mini seizure. And that's that depolarization event that's firing off all the nerve cell bodies in the brain. But the second part of the injury that occurs at the same time is as the brain's kind of a soft organ, so as it's bouncing back and forth, it deforms slightly. And so it stretches some of the wiring. And so you get the connectivity between the different parts of the brain and between the cells in the brain is disturbed and is not able to connect and send impulses the way it normally should. So those two parts of the injury, both a energy depletion and what leads to some oxidative damage of the cells in the brain, as well as a stretching injury with connectivity, those are the two main parts of the injury. And for the energy part of it, if you are able to, over several hours, 24 hours, you're able to reestablish the energy stores in the brain. Athletes who tend to be fairly well conditioned are particularly good at doing that. You'll see some of these athletes take tremendous hits during a game, look like they're knocked senseless, but they're standing up in the sidelines a little bit later, and they look like they might be thinking they want to go back in the game. But they have really good oxygenation in the brain that can start to replenish some of that energy. But the stretching of the axons and the connectivity problems, those are some of the things that can last and be a much longer term and contribute to those post-concussion syndromes, symptoms. And you can imagine if you're in a situation like you're an athlete or you're in the military and you're exposed to repeated concussions, then some of that stretching and connectivity issues can start to accumulate over time. And those can lead to, obviously, some of these longer-term conditions that we talk about, the CTE and other forms of dementia.
Right. Okay, so absolutely. Knowing that, then, tell us about the study and the OXE-103 and what it's designed to do.
Yeah, so OXE-103 is a naturally occurring hormone that's in our body. It's called ghrelin. And it's responsible for energy acquisition. It increases appetite, but it crosses the blood-brain barrier and binds to receptors in the brain. And when it binds to those receptors, it does things like it increases energy. So it's really important for maintaining energy balance in the brain. And one of the important things for the initial part of the injury, which is this depletion of energy, is when the brain starts to try to function and has no energy, it gets oxidative damage and free radicals that form that can be very damaging to the brain cells. And OXE-103 reduces oxidative reactive oxygen species in the brain in situations where it's low energy. So it's particularly well suited to that energy depletion by restoring energy and decreasing the oxidative damage. And the second thing that OXE-103 does, this ghrelin hormone does, is it causes increase in potentiation along the axons or the wiring of the brain. So it helps reestablish normal connectivity. And it causes an outgrowth of the wiring and reattachments to various cells. So, we're very interested in studying this both in the very acute injury as well as in the post-concussion syndrome. So our trial, the first patient population that we're looking at at Kansas University Medical Center, are patients that are they're within 28 days of their injury. Most of these patients have not gone to the emergency room or maybe not even sought medical help at the time of their injury. But they have gone through the medical system and they've had persistent symptoms, and now they're looking for help. And so that's the first patient population that we're studying. And that, that's the patient population that's very common, as we talked about earlier, patients mm-hmm. who have had an injury and are just looking for help days after the injury because they have persistent symptoms. And the second patient population that we're going to study is to recruit patients within the first 24 hours of their injury and treat them when they have those very acute symptoms. So it would be something that you would use, on the sidelines in the emergency room to treat a patient who had just come in from, car crash or falling off their bike or falling off the skateboard, falling down the stairs or getting severely injured in an athletic event.
Okay. So I just want to go back and process for a minute. That gives everybody else a chance to as well. But so I think it's the wiring. I got that. A lot of us have problems with cognition and the memory, so I imagine this drug would be targeting the hippocampus area as well. The typical areas of the brain that would be affected by concussion, is this kind of a shotgun approach to several areas of the brain then that would be playing to concussion symptoms?
So the receptors for this this hormone are highly concentrated in hippocampus, but they are across other areas of the brain. And there's, in some of the studies that have been done in the preclinical or animal studies that were done as models, have demonstrated increase in memory and improvements in cognitive function. So
okay.
I think it's going to play an important role in cognition and memory, but connectivity is related to, you know, the connectivity in the brain is related to, well, pretty much everything the brain does. So if you start to look at anxiety or depression, anger, sleeplessness, obviously some of the physical symptoms of balance and dizziness and headaches and things like that, those are probably all related closely to changes in connectivity that have occurred from the injury.
Okay, good. Now, going back to we want to fill the study, I have something here that talked about in the first clinical trial or phase one, you tested over 300 human subjects. And the drug exhibited a strong safety profile so far with treatment out to 84 consecutive days. So I guess what I'm getting to here is we're going to get to the point of and you did start talking about it, but I was just going to say, maybe have you just explain briefly in a few sentences, if that's what it takes, what you've done already. It's interesting for people to know about how these clinical trials work. And so, as I mentioned in the beginning of the show to listeners out there, we're looking to fill phase two of the clinical trial. So there's already been work done on this. You know, they've already gotten through the first phase of the clinical trial and are now looking to fill the second phase of the clinical trial. So in the first phase, it was shown to be effective out to 84 days. And so we're moving into the second part of the clinical trial. Again, the trial is in the Kansas City area, Kansas City Medical Center. Now, how do you, obviously, that first group you're looking for, people who've had a concussion within 28 days, if they know that they've had a concussion, and they live in the area of Kansas City, or they're well-versed enough in the possible catastrophic consequences and are able to get to Kansas City and want to participate in this study, then, you know, 28 days seems like a reasonable amount of time for someone to realize after a few days that things aren't right. It wasn't just a headache and a bad bang to the head and, you know, like a bruise you might get from bumping into the coffee table in a couple days, it's gone. It's something that's still bothering you a week out, 10 days out. And maybe the person, again, is well-versed enough to know that, wow, I think I might have a concussion and I'd like to especially if they're in sports or they're in the military, they're not going to be a stranger to the concussion. Like somebody, you know, who has a fall, and I had the whiplash type concussion. But so if you think that you have had a concussion in that 28 days, I was going to have you tell people how they could participate in part A, but the part B within 24 hours of injury, I think you said it, I just want to clarify it, that's a pretty short amount of time. Does that count? One of the clinical trials that I was involved with before had some qualifiers, and I just kind of want to talk to you about that a little bit. Within 24 hours, it may be kind of tough to tell unless someone, do you have any kind of a qualifier in there? Does it make a difference if you lost consciousness or not on either one of these parts? I'm going to stop with that first question just to see, because that was one of them in a clinical trial I worked with before. They didn't want anybody who had been unconscious or in a coma. You know, there were just some qualifiers as to the people that they would allow into the study. And their justification at the time is, you know, to take the easiest route to getting a drug approved, because it is very costly and takes so much time, that if you can at least get the drug to market, then it can more easily be diversified into working in other areas, in other demographics of people. So is there anything like that besides just the time period of group A is people that have been diagnosed within 28 days, and part B, you've got to really be on the ball to know within 24 hours that you've been concussed. You'd have to be taking a pretty serious hit and either have been knocked unconscious or be immediately throwing up with a blasting headache or something that would really get your attention within 24 hours, right?
Yeah, and the 24-hour group is a group that's intended to be consented from the emergency room. So we're expecting that these are all going to be patients that go to the emergency room, they're going to get worked up, and then they're going to be recruited into trial. So it's
okay.
You know, that's the place to start first, because that's the easiest place to get the patients within that 24-hour period, and then we can branch out for additional trials. But what I will say is, if someone is in the Kansas City area and is interested in seeing if they can participate in the trial, they can go to restisnotenough.com. And that is the website with the Kansas City portal system that asks what types of symptoms you have, asks you some questions, and then can get you involved in the trial if you go pass through the first set of questions. So just go to restisenough.com, restisnotenough.com.
Got it. Restisnotenough.com. Okay,
rest
go
is
on.
Not, now, some of the questions you asked. So our company is in a very unique position in that the drug that we're studying, OXC-103, was in development by a Japanese pharmaceutical, Daiichi Sankyo. They were not studying it for mild traumatic brain injury or any other neuro indications. And as I mentioned, one thing this molecule does do is increase appetite, which is, if you think about it, that's the first stage of bringing energy into the body. So they looked at it in indications like anorexia nervosa, and they looked at it in some wasting diseases because it increases lean body mass as well. We were able to license it from them for the area of neuroprotection for the mild TBI studies that we're doing. Now, the study, the data that you mentioned before, the 300 patients and the 84 days, that's data from Daiichi studies that they used through their phase 1 and phase 2 studies. And so the advantage for us is that's a very large safety database. In other words, a lot of people have been treated through phase one studies, and they've been treated for long durations of time. So we have a lot of safety data to tell us to use the drug. So that's the good news from what we were able to get through our license agreement. But just for folks listening to this discussion, you know, clinical development is costly. It takes a long time. The first stage is a phase one study. And usually those phase one studies are done in healthy volunteers to look at the safety of the drug. Once the safety of the drug has been established, then you move into phase two studies. And the phase two studies are studies that you start to understand how the drug can be applied to whatever disease condition you're looking at. So you might do several phase two studies and look at different patient populations. So we're looking at a patient population that has sustained the injury and now is having persistent symptoms. And we're looking at the first 28 days of those people who have those persistent symptoms. We're also looking at the other population we want to see within the first 4 hours. And so what you do in phase two is you might do multiple trials to try to determine the best way that the drug can be used for a particular disease condition. And then you take that information from phase two and you design a trial in phase three that will specifically target the population that it looks like it's going to have the most benefit for, or that you think it can have a real significant therapeutic benefit for. And the phase three trials the FDA looks at to approve the drug. So it's a fairly stepwise approach of development that first establishes safety, then it establishes the activity of the molecule and where it looks like it would have the most effect, and then it goes in and proves that with phase three trials that are statistically powered, and then it gets approved.
Okay, so we're in the two. You've gone through phase one proving the safety or validating the safety. So for those of you out there considering it, that part you've worked on in phase one. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Good.
So that's good to know, you know, if somebody's looking to volunteer and want to get involved in this. Certainly. So the safety has been looked at in phase one and phase two. Then, and this is what you're trying to fill now. And how long, I guess it depends, you know, on how quickly in any given study you get it filled, the phase filled. But then you're saying the next stage is when it actually comes to market.
Yeah,
is that correct?
Yeah, you take the data from your trials, and then you put that together in a submission to the FDA, and they evaluate it to see whether, the effect that you've observed is meaningful and accurate and is, worthy of approval. So then that process leads to the final approval of the drug. So right now we're in a phase two study demonstrating the activity in these patients, the two patient populations that I described, the 28 days and the acute patient population. Now, our concussion trials are lasting. We have, the current trial has 14 days of treatment, 2 more weeks of follow-up, and then we're following them up out to, I think, day 44 after their injury. So this trial can be, it's not like a, some trials where you're developing drugs for cancer, it could take multiple years to run the trial. So the major time that it takes to run our trial is just the time it takes to recruit the number of patients for the trial.
Super. Well, that's great. And then when we've talked about everything we've talked about, just to kind of, and then I'm going to go back and repeat the how you get in touch if you're interested in being in the clinical trial. And if you're interested in reading more about it, there's a fact sheet on the Auxia Pharmaceuticals website, and that website is actually OxiaLabPharma.com. But were you? I'm sorry.
Auxia Biopharma.
Right. Auxia Biopharma. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Bio Pharma.
Right. And that's where you can look and take a look at the fact sheet. But restisnotenough.com is where you want to go if you'd like to maybe participate in this trial. Now, is your hope that this drug would eliminate the concussive symptoms that a person has now and or have a chance of preventing future degenerative disease in the brain that people suffer due to even one good one, but usually repeated trauma to the head? What exactly is the objective?
So, you know, we had discussions with the FDA about our clinical protocol, and they gave us some guidance, which is fairly typical for most medicines, if you think about it. I mean, if you think about why you reach for a medicine, you know, if you have a migraine headache, you want your migraine headache to go away. And so what the FDA told us was that we need to demonstrate that our drug improves the way a patient feels and functions
post-concussion.
So, okay. If you think about what that really means from, you know, how diseases operate, A injury like a concussion, a head injury, the concussive injury that I described, what it's really doing is it's causing dysfunction in various parts of the brain cells and the connectivity that I described. And the symptoms are not going to go away until those dysfunctions have been turned back and things are functioning normally. So
Right. The
drug to make the patient feel better and to have the symptoms go away, there has to be some effect on the dysfunction and the damage in the brain. Now, the question is, does all that damage get corrected by the treatment, or can some of it accumulate over time? Could there be multiple injuries? And those are questions that we're going to study as these trials unfold. And as you might imagine, for some of these brain conditions, it's difficult because there's, in some cases, it's not understood exactly what causes them. So it's difficult to look for the underlying pathology. And in the case of concussion,
right,
thankfully, there's not a lot of structural damage to the brain. But we do expect that as the trials progress, there are some imaging techniques that look at metabolic profiles in the brain. There are some biomarkers now. There's a biomarker from the Abbott Lab, AbbVie, that it can be used to diagnose concussion, which is pretty exciting. And I think we're going to be seeing more and more things that will allow us to diagnose when patients have persistent damage that could lead to the CTE and the other long-term, you know, effects that we've been talking about.
Is one of the things you're talking about, the guest who's coming on after you in just a couple minutes, we were talking about, both of us had heard about a possible saliva test that on the spot they somehow did a strip on saliva right there, kind of like a pregnancy test, and it indicated whether or not you had a concussion. And then he asked me if I had ever heard of it, and I said yes, and he had heard of it, and now, you know, that like zapped off the radar, and neither of us has heard of it again for a long time. Do you know anything about that and whatever happened to it? Because you're right, it would be great if a diagnosis could be made in a more timely fashion, and then be able to get treatment with like the drug you're coming out with to relieve people of the symptoms, but to know for sure, because that was one thing I was, well, that's one question, period. And then the second question that goes with it is, do you actually have to have the diagnosis of a concussion before you get into the trial?
Yes. What happens in a clinical trial is there are different types of inclusion criteria that will get you into the trial. So there's diagnostic criteria for concussion, and then there's exclusion criteria, which would prevent you from being in the trial. So for instance, in this particular trial, we're not taking any patients who are younger than 18 years of age. So if you're younger than 18, that's an exclusion criteria. We expect to start trials in younger age groups as we go further in the phase 2 program. But you must have a diagnosis of concussion.
Okay, then what about that, just out of curiosity, before I let you go and you have any closing statement, had you heard of that saliva test or any test that would be coming out soon to get that diagnosis sooner so that a person could get onto a drug like you're planning to bring to market? Because if you're working on getting to it as soon as possible, you know, a lot of people don't manifest with their symptoms until a ways down the road. Now, if there's a circumstance that happens to a person, car accident, fall, bad hit in a sport, whatever it might be, where chances are pretty good that a person has had a concussion, but perhaps haven't gone to the right place to get a diagnosis and it can't be picked up on a scan, and we talked about the are you aware of any diagnostic that's on the horizon to be able to get to this drug quicker?
Well, I think there's a lot of diagnostics that are being looked at. The one that I mentioned that AbbVie has got approved is one diagnostic test that's out there already. The saliva test, I've looked at that in the past, but I'm not sure exactly where it is in development. I don't think it's not sure where it is
lost.
In the stage of development.
It's lost, I think. Yeah, I'm not sure that worked for them because there's things you hear about, and then we don't hear about it again.
So what we're doing in our trial is we're collecting blood samples several times during the trial. And then we, at the end of the trial, are going to test them with the available diagnostic tests that have gotten to the point where we think that they could have some validity. And it's very useful for those diagnostics to actually look at patients who have been on a therapeutic trial, because if we see a response to treatment, we want to have that correlate with a diagnostic test. So that information would be very helpful for both the diagnostic test and for us. And for patients to be able to develop that test.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, all very interesting and hopeful work, because as any of us who have had concussion know, it's hard to get diagnosed, nearly impossible to get treatment, super frustrating to live with the symptoms, and then to have the fear of what it might morph into. So, you know, it's a huge field of study, and I'm really encouraged that a therapeutic is on the horizon, especially you being in phase 2 of the trial. So if you're interested in this trial and you happen to live in the Kansas City area or have enough interest and symptoms that you're willing to travel for it, then again, I'd recommend that you look at the website that's going to give you some qualifiers. restisnotenough.com. And
yeah,
hopefully, you know, I'm sorry?
I was going to say, that'll get them directly to the trial, and then if they want to learn more about the treatment approach, they can go to our website at oxybiopharma.com. So both of those websites, one for the trial and one for the just the company and what our approach is, would be useful.
Exactly. Okay, great. Well, and listeners, if you weren't by a pen, we're 1 hour into the show, so you can always click on the show link. It's all over social media. There's a slider that'll take you right up to the 1 hour point. But also, many of you listeners know how to get a hold of me, either directly through my site or Brain Injury Radio, and I'm happy to pass those websites on to you if you're in a place where you haven't gotten them, been able to write it down. But Dr. Weiland, I really appreciate you your time tonight and explaining the trial to us. I hope we can get that phase two filled in and get this thing to market, because a therapeutic would really be appreciated by the people that are suffering the effects, of which there are many, and not a lot of places to turn at this point. So I'm excited about the new technology, and I wish you luck with it. And this show goes from live to archive, so a lot of people will be listening not only tonight, but in the future, near future, and on down the road, but hopefully closer to now to get that clinical trial filled. So thank you so much for being on. Is there any last thing you'd like to say?
Well, I would say to you, thank you very much for having me on. And we're very excited about, you know, this is a very large unmet medical need. And it's kind of exciting to work in a space like that where you can have so much impact on patients if we're successful in getting this trial to market. So, and, you know, I'd also like to commend you on this program and getting this whole topic out and talking about it and getting the athletes on and doing other things. I think it's fantastic, fantastic source for people who have had the injury and are still looking for what's new and what's happening out there. I think it's a great, great thing you're doing.
Well, thank you. And, you know, back at you on that, we'd like to have professionals that aren't suffering for it concerned about it, because like I read out of that article from The Hill, and what we're talking about all month this month is the prevalence of brain injury and how little there is to work with. I mean, we've all heard of cancer, diabetes, heart disease, and at 2.8 million people, and those are just the ones that are diagnosed. You know, you've got to look at how many others aren't diagnosed or that their symptoms show up down the road and they don't connect it. So there's the number is probably much greater, you know, and it's amazing how much isn't known and how many therapeutics there aren't. So I appreciate you going down this road.
Yeah, if you look at, you know, you look across military populations and civilian populations and athletes, and, you know, there's even been a lot of recent data on domestic violence. You know, across our society, there's just all different people that can be affected by this. And so, it's, you know, it's critically important. And the numbers are probably much larger than we think by looking just at, you know, if you look at hospital statistics and things like that. So, you know, we're very excited. And we've got, we do have Alex Smith, who's on our board. So Richard Sherman is an advisor to us. And so we have great input from the athletes, and we definitely recognize that. But we also recognize the other populations as well. So I think then that's one of the things that you're doing is, you know, making that well known.
Well, we're all trying, aren't we? Thank you so much, Dr. Michael Weiland, for being on the show tonight. And let's work on getting that second phase filled up and bring this therapeutic to market. Thanks for being here.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right. You bet.
Bye-bye.
Good night. Okay, everybody. That was Dr. Michael Weiland. And again, I'm going to give you those websites in case you've gotten a chance now to get a pen. OxyLabBiopharma.com will take you to their website. You can read more about the study, more about Dr. Wyand and what they're doing, the science of concussion. And again, the website to KC Med, where they're doing this study, is restisnotenough.com. And I'll post these two websites, by the way, in the comments on Brain Injury Radio Brain Injury Radio page on Facebook and my inaflash.org page on Facebook. Right when I get off the air tonight, I'll put down those two websites underneath the program so you'll see them boldly right there. I know some people are driving or sitting in the recliner and not by a pen, and I want to make sure that you're able to get the information, the further information that you need, and I thank him for being here tonight. So while we're on the subject of concussion, I was blessed to meet someone through a mutual friend, actually, and this is a help page. I want to give Chris credit for having this Facebook help page on concussion and CTE, and she introduced me to our next guest, and he is one of those athletes who has had a lot of experience with concussion. Rico Petrini, number 49, an all-conference linebacker and team MVP at Oregon State University, is going to share how he went from near perfect health to extreme behavioral, neurological, and physical changes this past year at 49 years old, and the clinical trial using photobiomodulation that might have saved him. With that, I am going to bring on Rico, and I'm going to thank Chris for introducing us. Rico, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for being here on such short notice, and I really enjoyed our talk last night.
Thanks for having me.
Moving
Sam.
So
I really
fast. Yes, I appreciate you being here. So you were kind of an all-around athlete. You played in a lot of different sports, but found your way to the football field in college. And as I just said, were a most valuable player at Oregon State. Tell us a little bit about your experience. We've got an hour. Another athlete, because we hear about so many of them that are suffering concussion, and I know that you've done a lot of research because you've got some pretty serious issues that hit close to home and how many people are affected. So I'd like to start out hearing about your story and where you're at, and then that gave you impetus to do some research to learn more about your condition. And that's, you know, one of the things that I think is great about you and the talk that we had, but it's also something that I find very sad for so many of the people afflicted, because, you know, at this moment, and you know, my good luck to Dr. Wyland and anybody who's out there working on our behalf for therapeutics. But, you know, you're the first person I've talked to that's really gone out and done some research on their own. There's so many that don't even realize. They realize something's wrong. They're suffering through cognitive issues. I've got a whole list. I'll let you touch on yours first when you're talking, and then I've made a list of a dozen things over the dozen years that I've been here that seem to keep coming up over and over and over, that people with head injury don't always suffer all 12, but every single head injury suffers some amount of my list of 12, and they don't even know where to start looking. The doctors in the traditional medical model haven't been the best at helping with solutions. And so, you know, my hat's really off to you for the work you've done on your own behalf in finding out about this. A lot of people either aren't able, just flat-ass aren't able, because of the cognitive damage, the memory issues and all of that, and just aren't physically or emotionally able to do it. And, you know, that's a really difficult proposition, because then you're really in the dark hole for a lot longer because you don't know where to turn, and yet you're living with it every day, and it's affecting your family and everyone you come in contact, and they can't see it, but you're living with it all the time. So with that, I'm just going to let you talk. Tell us about you, what happened to you, and how you got acquainted with concussion and brain injury.
Yeah, well, first of all, Kim, thank you for this opportunity. I do really appreciate the time and, you know, the chance to share, as you said, the invisible injury, which unfortunately is the most serious one that we'll carry through our entire lives, but that often when we're playing, we don't realize it's even occurred. For me personally, I started with football. I did many other sports. Anything that my mom could get me out of the house with, she had me in. So from surfing to motorcycle riding, dirt bikes, horses, wrestling, track, baseball, soccer, pretty much did it all as a kid. But I really focused in high school on football. Was kind of my core sport. And so I played that for 4 years at inside linebacker, which is a very contact-intensive position, and was fortunate enough to do pretty well that I was offered a scholarship to play up at Oregon State. One of the things that my school was Sarah High School in the Bay Area, so one of the fun claims to fame is it's the same high school that Tom Brady went to. So, you know, that was somebody else that was in the footsteps there as well at that school. But so
very
I went
cool.
on to Oregon State. Yeah. I got in the Hall of Fame before him too, so that's my little one up. But So I went up to Oregon State and was very fortunate. The program was in a rebuild cycle, and so I got an opportunity to play as a freshman, and I actually started all 4 years that I was there, again, at inside linebacker. The estimates on that were that I probably overall in my career, I've probably taken over 15,000 subconcussive hits, and I probably had at least 25 concussions plus and 3 to 4 seriously, you know, medically evaluated concussions. I was fortunate to not, you know, I never lost consciousness. But I had a couple periods where one case I thought the team doctor was my dad and I was showing him my pretty shoes. So, you know, it's one of those things that when it goes bad, you know, you have no idea where you're at. And we actually watched the film on that game and I was running circles in the middle of the field, and that's how they knew to pull me out because I had, obviously had no idea what was going on.
Talking about with Dr. Weiland is the things like that. You know, yes, it's the invisible injury, but if people are really paying attention, there are tells like what you just cited, you know, and in the past, you know, even with the safety protocols they put in, one of the things I talked to Ray about last week was that the problem with that is that it's all self-policing. You know, oftentimes the player, one of a couple of things, either doesn't know what's going on, so they really can't advocate for themselves, or they're getting peer pressure oh, come on, you just got your bell rung, you know, especially if you're a valuable player, they want you back in. The coach wants to be successful and have wins and keep his job and look good. The team doctor, if there is one, really doesn't have a basis for making a call at that moment. Like I said, you know, I was able to answer a few basic questions, what's my name and who's the, what day is it and all of that. And I was in the middle of a brain bleed, for God's sake, you know. And with that whole thing being self-policing, the safety protocols, I guess, are better than what we had before. But there are some tells where you take those people out of it, or at least make them be accountable for noticing when somebody is having obvious, not coherent as they were before that hit they just took, staggering, running circles on the field, like you just mentioned. You know, the coaches and the other players, rather than the peer pressure bullying thing, really have to help each other be accountable, because they all have brains too. So I think there needs to be an attitudinal change among the players now, knowing that this kind of thing's going on, and the spectators who know you and the coach have to be really in tuned to those tells.
Yeah, you've hit two really strong points, Kim. One of them is some consistent protocol with concussions. Now, one of the interesting things about that is, as you probably know, all collegiate sports are overseen by the NCAA. They, as an athlete, they make sure that the school and us as players follow, you know, educational eligibility requirements. They test us for steroids and other drugs. You know, they basically oversee every facet of our student athlete life. Yet what you might find interesting is that, you know, they started talking about the severity of concussions in 1994, and obviously CTE had come out in, I think, 2002 with Dr. Amalu. But the NCAA itself has put out what they call guidelines through almost 20 years, but they don't require the schools themselves to actually follow their guidelines. The schools actually can set up their own evaluative criteria. So it's kind of an empty rule book, because, you know, they're saying we're doing this, and yet the schools themselves are really can interpret it how they want and enforce it how they want. So, you know, in my case, according to, you know, Michael Weiland's, you know, your last guest kind of criteria for a concussion, I would have been getting his nose spray every day, because, you know, I was puking during practice. I was seeing stars. You know, I would get my, quote, bell rung. And unfortunately, I played through those. I was a 17-year-old kid, and, you know, whether it was the time and people not knowing or what have you, you know, unfortunately, I did play a while back. But nonetheless, those things, particularly those subconcussive hits, we're learning are the ones that can really do some damage. So when we think of concussions and even potentially in the future CTE, we need to think about, you know, all sports. In high school, for instance, I think the top five sports, three of them are women's sports, you know, basketball, volleyball, and soccer, you know. So, yes, football is on the top, but there's a lot of diversity in how you can get those injuries, and we need to treat them all equally and with equal severity.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, when you say that, I just want to tell you a quick, I had her as a host for a while, but I had a mom, even with all of that, you mentioned the beforehand things, her daughter played soccer. And they sat down, the school sat down and had them watch a movie about the possible, about concussion and about things that can happen. And the kid wanted to play so bad, And, you know, but mom, you know, anyway, the bottom line is that it fell into something that is all too common, and that's that it won't happen to me. And
yes.
I guess what I've seen and why I encourage that change of players advocating for each other, with each other, as opposed to making it harder on each other and doing a peer pressure kind of thing is that, you know, it why not? Yeah, it's gonna happen to people. Why not you? And that was what Concussion Mom was the name of her show. I think she even has a page out there. But her daughter, very early on in playing, got a bad injury from repeated concussions, and she felt horrible about it because she just thought it would never happen to them, you know, and that's a big caution I have for everybody is, yeah, it very well could happen to you, and you can't unring the bell once it's happened.
Yeah, there was a study that just came out, in fact, today from Israel that stated that in kids under 12, that when they get a concussion, one out of four will suffer chronic post-concussion syndrome. So you're looking at something that, you know, potentially can be a lifetime or a life-altering change to you, you know. And so in my case, the interesting thing, you know, I've been evaluated as suspected CTE. So in my case, I actually, you know, I had the concussions. The most I ever sat out, though, was one day for, you know, any of the concussions that I had. And, you know, we'd play on a Saturday. I'd be watching film Sunday morning. So, and I don't fault the medical staff. I just think it was, you know, a combination of a different time and a different attitude towards it. But nonetheless, you know, I thought I had escaped unharmed. You know, like Dr. Weiland said, you have this skull and you imagine it as this armor and that your brain is safe inside and not thinking of it, your brain is butter getting sloshed around in there. And, you know, I survived and thought I had made it through school with minimal injuries. And I was pretty bomb-proof for almost 30 years. I didn't even have to do annual checkups. I mean, I was in great shape. I was in great health. I had none of the common morbidities that you'd be concerned about. You know, was really living a pretty good life neurologically, physically, and so forth. But in March of this last year, I had an incident. My wife had a very serious illness and was in the ICU for 17 days. And what I've learned now is that an incident like that can actually trigger the progression of CTE symptoms, and that is in fact what happened to me. You know, immediately after and during her hospital stay, I started having issues, and typically they present as mood or behavioral issues. So I found myself in severe depression. I also had anxiety, explosive anger. I was having difficulty with focus, concentration, blurred vision. My hormone level had dropped from 900 to 60. I was having an erratic heartbeat. You name it, almost every system in my body in a three-month period like went haywire. And it was just completely bizarre to me. And, you know, granted, I knew I had some stress related to what was going on with my wife, but, you know, that couldn't account for all of these things happening at this one time. And so, you know, knowing my history and having seen the movie Concussion and knowing that I did take a lot of hits, I got on the group that you were talking about, the CTE and Global Support Group that Chris Boyce runs. And, you know, I went in and I kind of shared my story. And it was amazing. On the first day, you know, one of the other people in the group put me in contact with Larry Carr, who is running a clinical trial University of Utah for photobiomodulation. And so he was seeking, you know, 35 applicants that were football players that had a history of concussions. And I, you know, by the grace of God, I literally fell right into the study. And so the next day I was signed up for it. And thankfully, by July, I was taking my first plane trip out to the University of Utah Neurology Department to start the baseline testing.
And what is that treatment, biomodulation?
So photobiomodulation is the use of red and near-infrared light. How it is used is it's actually it's a headset that's put onto the various areas of your brain, and this type of light at a focused energy can actually penetrate the skull. And what it does is it stimulates the mitochondria, which are kind of the powerhouses of your cells, and causes ATP production, which is an energy form, which helps the brain in particular with, issues that brain injury survivors typically deal with, you know, the lack of oxygen to the brain, neural connections, blood flow, neural repairs, mental, brain fog, all of these various issues, it really does an incredible job with. And so, with that was one of the things I had never heard of it before either. It's very cutting edge. And Larry had kind of shared with me a video that he had done and his own experience. And what's unique about him is he was not only a football player at Brigham Young and a very good one, but he also was a neurologist. So as you said, Kim, us in our own community knowing each other and knowing CTE or knowing brain injuries really helps us support each other. He was a really unique situation with a doctor that you had somebody that had played football that experienced suspected CTE himself and was actually literally patient one using photobiomodulation. So it was really a unique experience. And so I was just so fortunate to be a part of that small group and almost feel guilty sometimes, the survivor's guilt that I was one of the fortunate ones that did get to participate in that.
Well, let me ask you, when you were able, because of the time that had passed, and I understand what you're saying from your end of things, that when everything started melting down in symptoms that many years later, if you hadn't had a clue of any of those symptoms prior to that time in your 30 years down the road, this is kind of a new concept of having an injury that gets triggered by something later down the road. So he had no doubt when you got into this clinical trial, and he's a doctor, he had no doubt that what was happening to your body came from the cumulative effects of something that happened 30 years before.
With CTE, currently the technology, you can't tell definitively that somebody has it until death, where they actually do a brain staining of the brain tissue and can check for various proteins and so forth to make that determination that someone has had it. So in the living, it's a little more challenging. However, for purpose of clinical trials such as this, the leading minds in neurology at Boston U and at other, reputable schools, hospitals, and so forth, came together in a convention and developed some criteria for, diagnosing, for the purposes of clinical trials in the living. And, those tests include some physical tests, some mental tests, and the behavioral tests. And through the three of those, they're learning more that there seems to be a kind of a progression or a pattern that suspected CTE follows that they could then make it with a, a pretty strong level of confidence, a determination that, that I was suspected CTE, especially in this trial. They were taking football players that had at least pro level experience or college. So they, these were players who had, between 9 and 20 years of football. And so that was another real driver for, whether this would be a good group to do a trial on because of the amount of contact and concussive hits. So, yeah, there was a strong, sense of certainty that I had that. And, again, joining that CTE and brain injury group, when I went in, it really, I felt so comfortable. I mean, I had isolated myself at that point, from my wife and my family and other folks, because nobody really understood what was going on with me. And it was really the first time that I was around a group of people that got what it's like to deal with a brain injury. And so that was really refreshing to know that I wasn't alone in the struggle. And then, of course, the results I got from, doing the photobiomodulation exceeded all of my expectations. So, what ended up happening is in July was my first date, so July 15th. By that time, I had already had symptoms expressing since March, and I was on a pretty hard decline. I was crying every day driving to work. I was having dark thoughts, depression, and the likes. And I just did not feel like I had any energy left or strength, mentally or physically. And, when I got on the plane to go. Yeah. And when I got on the plane, this was it. This was my, Hail Mary, so to speak, that this was either going to work or it wasn't, because I didn't know how I was going to be able to handle it otherwise. So, I got in and we did the baseline testing. We did some physical tests, and one of them involved getting out of a chair. And I tried to get out of a chair with no hands, and I fell backwards, and these two poor women had to try to catch, a 250-pound guy that was falling towards the floor. And I don't think they were expecting that I was in that bad of condition. I couldn't stand on one foot. I couldn't do a simple figure eight in a cone test without looking at the ground. The game, memory as a kid, I couldn't get more than two matches without having problems. I mean, it was, as you said, well, how did they know? When they see somebody in person like that, it's pretty definitive that, that someone is dealing with this, when you see that kind of severity in response.
Yeah.
So after we did that.
Absolutely.
I'm sorry. So after that, we did a functional MRI after that. So that was, they did that scan just to get the baseline for me. And then after that, they gave me the actual Violite and taught me how to use it. So that was 20 minutes every other day for 8 weeks is the study. So I took that. It was all done at home. They would check on us weekly. So fast forward a little bit, 2 weeks in, I start feeling a little mentally more clear, and, I've got a smile on my face, and, I'm kind of whistling in the shower. My wife's kind of surprised because she hasn't seen me smile or whistle in a while. And so that was kind of the first thing that, hey, maybe something's working here. And so I kind of asked Larry, am I supposed to feel anything this early? And he goes, well, from my experience, yeah, that's kind of what happened with me. And honestly, I was still a little bit of a skeptic. You're putting these red lights on your head. I was like, seriously, these look like Christmas lights to me. It doesn't seem like it could possibly be doing what you're saying. But, nonetheless, I stayed with it. And at a month, I felt about 30 to 40% better than I had when I started the trial. And, I was moving around.
Wow.
I was interactive with my kids again. Yeah, I was, I had more energy. I was, had a better relationship with my wife. I wasn't having any of the behavioral or mood issues like the, particularly, the anger or the verbal outbursts. Those things all, subsided. And when I got to 8 weeks, I was a new me. I mean, I felt like I was probably 80 to 90% back to where I was pre, you know, symptoms, which was great because I was really afraid. I was the breadwinner. I was afraid I was going to lose my job. I thought, you know, I was going to continue to downward spiral. I didn't even know if I would make it, you know, mentally and physically. And yet, you know, when they brought me back, I was excited to get on that plane. You know, I was ready, like, you know, being in a football game. I was ready to go and show them what I could do, you know, and I was excited. And we went through and did the physical tests. And, you know, I did it almost like when I was in college. I moved fluently. I had no issues. I could stand on one foot for as long as they needed me
wow.
to. Obviously, the chair. Yeah, obviously, the chair was no longer a problem. My reaction times were much improved, you know, on all of the tests that I was doing with that. The mental tests, you know, memory and so forth, I was remembering, you know, 7-8 pairs with no issue. I got all the language
wow.
and the matchup tests, you know, were almost, you know, close to as flawless as I could get them. And so it all went incredibly well. I mean, and I was just, I knew I was doing better, but to do that, I was in total disbelief. I mean, I was just like, this is a total game changer. And mind you, I wasn't doing anything else during that timeline. I was doing some supplements, but I didn't do like hyperbaric oxygen treatment. I didn't do, I did some chiropractic, but I didn't do any, you know, types of rehabs through, you know, quote, the traditional medical system. And in fact, when I saw my neurologist for the first time during this period, he said, yeah, you know, that whole CTE thing, I don't know a whole lot about that, and that doesn't really interest me, so I'm going to refer you out. So, you know, I mean, that was the response I got. Yeah. And so, you know, that just blew my mind, but it also made me realize, you know, for this community in particular with brain injuries, if we don't help ourselves, you know, the medical side has not caught up. And if we don't help ourselves, like Dr. Weiland said, you're going to sit 2 months waiting for an appointment, and then they're going to take your, you know, your blood pressure and, you know, check your tonsils and, you know, ask you a couple questions and probably put you on an antidepressant because the first symptoms yeah. that get expressed are severe depression and anxiety. And in most cases, the antidepressants they're going to put you on are going to make you worse, because they don't interact well with CTE or traumatic brain injury.
Well,
so
yeah,
many of them
they
actually,
play.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say that
no.
it's a, yes, they do that 100% of the time. And what I've always found freakish about that is that it plays right to the symptoms. I mean, if you've got brain fog and neurofatigue and you know, a lot of the other symptoms that we experience, those are side effects. Those are possible side effects to the antidepressants.
Right.
And so, you know, if you already had brain fog, you got it times two. That was part of my frustration of going from doctor to doctor to doctor and hearing thousands of people over the years I've been here talk about the same process of going through different doctors in the traditional medical model, ultimately winding up at the shrink's office, and the pill that they're getting described isn't something like what Dr. Weiland's working on, which I would like to say that for the study that you had, which is further down the road and potentially
right.
graver consequence when you're talking about the degenerative part of things, if
True.
This clinical trial goes, when it gets through that Dr. Weiland's doing, wouldn't it be nice if way back 30 years ago when you were getting those concussions, there would have been a therapeutic that may have prevented you from getting to the place that you did 30 years later. My hats are off to both of the doctors, because one's working on the front
yeah.
end at the point that it's a concussion, and the doctor that you found at BYU is got a therapeutic to help people that are experiencing the more advanced symptoms that we hear about for what those repeated concussions can morph into later in life down the road. So thank God that you were able to get into that clinical trial. And what I tell people when they talk about the survivor guilt is there's a reason, you know, there's a reason. It wasn't available. All this isn't available to everybody. But the point, you know, I think one of the reasons to not feel survivor guilt is the fact that you were meant to do exactly what you did and are fluent enough talking about it that you're a good communicator and have the reach through different sources. You know, you've been all over the Facebook page is this group that we're talking about, by the way, listeners. It's on Facebook, and it's a wonderful resource. And coming on the radio and talking about it, where we're airing to all 50 states, 49 countries, and the show will go from live to archive, for people to be hearing about the hope of these things coming out. We lose a lot of people to hopelessness because they go through that cycle that we've heard so many that you went through, that I went through in my own way, and that people are going through every day, and they don't know that there's hope out there that things can get better. So the fact that, yeah, you know, you were one of the first one, as you put it, to fall into that clinical study, I didn't know about it until you got here tonight. So how many thousands of other people now have the hope, oh my God, that there's something out there, and here's a guy just like what, a little different than what you experienced and I experienced. I experienced here for the first time, and you experienced in the group for the first time, that feeling at home and feeling understood, the validation part of things. And then that led to solutions and therapeutic, a study that worked, and now are able to tell people that this hope is out there, that there are people, you know, tonight's show with you and with Dr. Weiland at the beginning, that's two different people. One that has got your doctor, you know, in fact, is that clinical study, I mean, we're talking fairly recent about your treatment, like what phase, yeah, of the clinical trial, or is that, when are they expecting that, well, that's going to be out there for anybody?
So great question. That was an open study. They are going into the next phase of the study, probably within the next month or so. And I think they'll be lining up enrollment with that. I did talk to Dr. Carr actually before the show here, and he said they're just finalizing the compilation of the results from my group. But he said, you know, this was his quote, he had said, you know, if this, the results we got, if this was Big Pharma, it would be national headlines. You know, this is a natural therapy that, you know, doesn't have the side effects, doesn't have any of the other issues of some of the pharmaceuticals, and some of those risks, you know, so it doesn't make, you know, front page news, unfortunately. But as you said, hopefully the awareness here, it will truly help the people that need it. And as you said, you know, I try to look at my opportunity and the blessing that I got as a chance for me to take my hardship and be of service to others. So I'm very active in that CTE and brain injury global support group that Chris put together, as are many others. And there's really a lot of good information share there. And one other thing I would like to say too about that is, you know, it's a group that's also for caregivers and, you know, brain injury sufferers. And I want to stress that point because, you know, my symptoms, as you said, I mean, how do you know that this happens and how do you put it together 30 years after you played? And yet I am basically, I am the prototype case. The way my symptoms express, the timeline, the average person with suspected CTE, it presents in between your mid-40s to mid-50s. And so it usually presents with some significant behavioral shifts. You know, like I said, the explosive anger, the anxiety, severe depression, suicidal thoughts in people that would never have had them. And so it's really paramount that people that love them and are close to them, if you see any of these significant changes, that you do try to get some immediate help. Because as I shared, and I'm a very spiritual person, and I'm not taking anything away from anybody that's ever experienced or thought about suicide. But in my case, you know, for me to take that step, anybody that knew me would say there's no way he would ever do that. He loves his family. He loves his job. He loves his life. It just would not be on the radar. And yet the changes that happen to your brain at that time, you know, you're it's not the person who you were that everybody knows. You know what I'm saying? That the chemical changes that happen.
I do.
Your serotonin changes, the dopamine changes, the hormonal changes, the actual brain chemistry and functioning changes. Like I said, every system in my body was affected. I went from never going to a doctor to, twice a week seeing specialists. I saw ear, nose, and throat, audiologist because of tinnitus. I saw a urologist, hormone people, you name it. I saw them during that period. And, you know, they ended up checking every box to the point that really this was the only thing left it could be. So, that's if I can leave people with anything is, I shared this first privately with my alumni group for football, and I told them what was happening to me because these were guys I played with. I knew they had the same amount of hits as me. I knew they had played at the same time, and I knew they were at the age that this would present. And, I just said, I want to do this because I love you guys, and I want to make sure that you are at least aware that this can happen because it happened to me. And I thought as a team leader that, I could reach them because sometimes your family can't reach you. And it was amazing. I put that up in our group, our private alumni group, and yet, right after I did that, I had probably 12 to 15 guys reach out to me from all different eras of my college's football saying, I was wondering what was going on. I just thought this was getting old, part of getting old and not knowing that there was probably so much more going on. So being able to get them in early and have them try to start some supplements and do some treatments, it's an incurable condition currently, but that doesn't mean that you can't slow the progression or even stop it. So that's really the goal right now is to try to work towards those two things to improve quality of life.
Right. And, that's the same, is true with Parkinson's. There's still not a definitive test that the bell rings and you get a diagnosis. It's a matter of checking boxes like this.
Exactly.
So, when I mentioned to you last week, the first time I had heard of CTE or probable CTE being attached to someone who was living was last week with a guest of mine. But I get how that is. I have someone very close to me and my family with Parkinson's, and there wasn't a definitive test that gave him that diagnosis. It was a matter of checking the boxes. Wondering if it kind of makes me wonder anyway at the point we're at, we just under 10 minutes, but I concur with you that people, that you would not think would get to that level of desperation or have suicidal ideation. What happens when you're hopeless? That's another thing. You know, you talk about all the different things that shift in your system. You know, you don't know yourself as you anymore. And there's a black void where it doesn't look like there's hope. So you've morphed into something you don't recognize. You can't articulate it because you don't understand it. And you feel hopeless because there isn't any, in the traditional medical model, like coordinator of care. You know, we're all going out there blind, you know, hitting different doctors in the traditional medical model, doing new age holistic things, trying vitamins, trying diet, doing yoga, being mindful, taking antidepressants, you know, and we're doing this ping pong approach alone. And so I would encourage everybody to check out these, if you're on Facebook, you know, checking into these support groups, checking into support groups that are person to person, wherever you're at with COVID at this moment. Some of them even have Zoom meetings or, you know, visiting places like here, like Brain Injury Radio, just going places where there's other like-minded people who have walked the same road. Granted, we all have our own unique story, but the brain is the brain is the brain. And so a lot of the symptoms we're going to be talking about and feelings we're going to be talking about, you're going to identify with and are going to validate your feelings. And then you say, well, okay, so I'm validated and I'm not alone. I still think it sucks to feel this way. You know, I just don't think I'm going to be able to handle this forever. Well, believe it or not, you stick around long enough and you hear people raise the beacon of hope, you know, like tonight with both of my guests talking about hopeful treatments, one in one realm to try to hit it early on when it's a concussion and before it gets to that point, and then a more holistic approach that is helping people, and to be able to know that somebody is working on. That was one of the problems. We all went so long without any of this. You know, I mean, when I started, they didn't make internet yet. You know, I mean, I was in 1995, and so I tell people, you know, that there were none of these groups. You know, I wasn't computer savvy. Everybody didn't have a computer on their desk yet. If there was internet, I wasn't aware, and I wasn't in much shape to learn how to use it. Social media is what I'm talking about. There was internet. There wasn't social media. So, you know, you didn't find these kind of groups. And when you called a lot of the different associations or alliances, I was talking about this with a host last night. I kind of came on his show as a caller, and we were just talking about that it's a great place to go during Awareness Month when you're looking for statistics. But if you're the person who's recently injured, suffering, and you call them because they're representing our demographic by virtue of their names, these associations and alliances, there's an expectation by those of us that are afflicted that they're going to have something to help us. So while we're bouncing around to doctors, you know, we're getting a hold of some of these places, and they're going, well, we just raise awareness in the community. We don't really have anything that will help you now that you're damaged, you know, now that you're injured.
Yeah.
You know, we can't really help you much. You know, we can put statistics and costs and try to raise awareness in the public that this is going on. You know, that doesn't help us that suffer from these things every single day. So, you know, I encourage you now that now that there is social media, now that there is a little more awareness. I know not here where I live anymore. There was one for less than a year, but checking out support group. And again, aligning, you got to have some balance. There's so many people that don't get the invisible, including us a lot of the time, that the thing that can really save your life and help bring back acceptance to these cards that you've been dealt and now how to best play them is other people that have gone through a similar type thing, and we learn from them and get support from them, and that makes it better. You know, it really does, to know that we're not alone and to possibly find some solutions like you did, Rico, that helped you by interfacing in that group. And now you're sharing it not only in the group, but the other group that you mentioned that you were involved in, and now on the radio. And I think the more of us that are talking about it, then one person tells another person who tells two people who tells five people. And like anything else, people start learning exponentially. And that support goes a long way to giving you the stamina to keep going until you find
exactly that
new normal, you know, that's going to work the best for you. So I really appreciate you coming on tonight, especially with the short notice. And I want to thank Chris particularly for hooking us up. I think, you know, I too am a spiritual person and I believe in divine intervention, and I think we had it because I had this back hour of the show and talked to Chris about it, and I'm a member in a number of those groups. I'm not there as much as I would like to be because I'm always talking. I'm always talking on the radio or prepping with guests and talking with guests and all of that. But I do appreciate those groups so much because there's many people in the various groups on Facebook that have been guests on the show and that are helping so much by having these groups that people can go to and find, you know, that support and get that hope. And I think that that's really important, is not only raising awareness during Awareness Month for outsiders, but for insiders as well, because there's new ones every day, and there's ones that have been suffering a long time that are just finding help and it's making a difference in their lives.
Exactly. Yes. And that's,
so thank you.
That's really where it's at. Bottom line is, you know, unfortunately, brain injuries are expensive to treat. And so that's why even the top people like NFL players, you would think they would have this whole circle around them of care. And yet most of the guys I talked to when they left the NFL didn't know anything about their injuries or that they could be long term. So, you know, whether it's the healthcare industry or the NFL, it's really costly to treat these. So unfortunately, they aren't putting a lot of time into, you know, validating whether people really have it or not. And I don't want to be cynical and think it's a matter of dollar and cents, but sometimes it feels like that to us that deal with this because it has been so long with so little progress. But we have each other, and that's what we need to lean on, because that's how the information gets shared, and that's how we find cost-effective and efficient ways to get better treatment. So thank you for what you're doing here, too. This is an incredible voice for us, you know, that are not only invisible injuries, but also the silent, you know, and unheard in society. So we definitely appreciate it.
Absolutely. Just a minute, because we have 10 seconds. For those of you I'm losing right now, good night, God bless. Thank you so much for being here. And the show is in its entirety when you play it on demand. Okay, I needed to say that. We're into overtime now, and there's a lot of people who can no longer hear us. But it's okay, because when people go to play the show back, they're going to hear it in its entirety. But for those that were going to be dropping off due to no fault of their own, I wanted to thank them for being here and tell them good night and God bless. But, you know, a last comment on that money situation, you know, it really, I don't think, you know, the NFL, they weren't forthcoming in the beginning, you know, back before a concussion was made. They knew for decades. We talked about the other night, there's still people going. There's still people playing, but I mean, the dirt was out there for decades and they kept it under wraps. And yeah, it was about money. It certainly wasn't about lives. And you and me talked last night about what I've heard and talked about with a lot of other NFL and college football players and even parents of Pop Warner age kids, that the values and all of the things that you learn playing the sport, and someone like me sitting back in this chair going, wow, and the NFL or those schools were not interested in those values at all. You were a commodity, you know, yeah, a commodity that played to their pocketbooks. And there's a good reason why they wouldn't want to put that information out there. You know, yeah, money has a lot to do with it, but a lot of people might not want to participate, you know, and take that chance. And I don't know if I told you this the other night, and then I'll let you go, but when Chris Nowinski was on my show, I said, and we were talking about the Legacy Foundation, and that's one right thing I might want to just spit out while we're having this show tonight, is it's not a regular autopsy. It's a special autopsy of the brain, and there's just a few places in the country that will do it. Boston University is very well known for it. Chris Nowinski has Legacy Foundation that's also in the Boston area. The VA has a facility in the Boston area. And if you are willing to donate your brain, they're going to be learning more about these degenerative diseases and CTE. And some people might, you know, they don't want that in the NFL. What would happen if players decided that they didn't want to do that, or that the NFL didn't think that it was as excited, or that they could charge as much for season tickets if they were to put safety protocols in, for example. You and I talked about that. So I said to Chris, after this whole show we had on Legacy Foundation years ago, after the movie Concussion came out, I say to him just kind of offhandedly, if you had it to do again, would you? And he said, absolutely, which, again, from my chair, my chin dropped on the floor. We just got done spending 2 hours talking about donating brains to learn more about CTE and the three players in the beginning, you know, one of whom shot himself in the chest with a note, you know, to look at his brain because innately he knew something was going on. And I said, would this change your mind? Because I had done a little homework. I said, there's one insurance company, one, and it's actually an entertainment company that has some underwriting from one insurance company that will even insure the NFL. And in Pop Warner, there's one other insurance company. And my background was 25 years as a financial consultant, and I did a lot of work selling employee benefit packages. And what I know about insurance is when there's one company, when all the actuaries of all the insurance companies that know they could make a frickin' fortune by insuring, having an account like the NFL or Pop Warner, what, you know, that's a lot of grease in one of those companies.
Yeah.
And when an insurance company says, there isn't a price we could charge that would make us want to take on this risk. No.
Yeah, that tells a lot, huh?
Yeah, that's huge. These people, the bean counters, you know, and the actuaries have looked at the statistics and go, wow, we can't even come up with a premium we think would make it worth our while to take on this group, and you've got one that does. What happens when there's one? Well, what one is going to do is the price is, you know, they can raise the price to whatever they want to because you got no other choices of where you're going to go. The other thing they can do that a lot of people don't look at in school sports, they think they're covered because they buy the school policy or the Pop Warner insurance, whatever. And one thing they don't look at is that it will cover you for that knee injury that the doctor was talking about earlier, the obvious things, but they have a limitation of like $1,000 from your neck up.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
For the kids. Well, and neither did Kevin, or Chris, I'm sorry. So when I said to Chris, would it make a difference to you in saying that, because it's a little shocking to me, and I said that it's a little shocking to me that after this discussion that you say that you would go back and do it again, because that lends itself to why news is out now and people keep going in the NFL is just not having a shortage of players, you know, it's still going strong. And when I said to him, would it make a difference if you knew you were not insured? And he said, well, yes. And he was as vehement about the yes. No, he wouldn't take the risk if he didn't have insurance. And I said, well, you don't have to quite worry about that yet because there is one company insuring these two organizations, two different one companies, one for Pop Warner and one for the NFL. But, you know, eventually what they'll start doing, if they haven't already, I haven't seen the policy lately, but, you know, it'll cover you for things like all the different injuries that you can get that, and then put limitations from the neck up.
Wow. Yeah. Well, it's the same as the medical coverage right now for us too. It's the same boat. I mean, trying to get spec scans and all these special scans that we need to kind of affirm our condition so that many people can get disability or what have you. You know, you have to basically be printing money to, you know, just to be able to establish your case. And it's really unfortunate. There's so many people in our group that I know of that know they have the condition and yet keep getting rejected for disability or keep having other barriers to them getting the treatment that they need because, you know, the limitations, as you said, in HMOs and their coverage and, you know, with no way to truly identify the extent of the injuries, like with my own even, you know, to be able to establish how they're going to care for it. So it's really unfortunately, it's a big gray area. You know, above the shoulders, as you said, is a really big gray area. And yet it should be the most important and cherished and, you know, the most money dumped into. And, you know, and yet it's not, you know, hip replacements and knee replacements are the thing that, you know, insurance are happy to do, but, you know, forget anything involving your brain.
Well, and that's exactly right. And, you know, I won't go into politics, but the more we go toward universal health care, you know, the more everybody thinks it's great. You can walk in and get a free physical and you get these little, what I call value-addeds, teasers, But when it comes to the big stuff, you know, there's going to be some limitations. There isn't any way to have affordable health care, quote-unquote affordable health care, and have everything covered. So what you are going to see, in spite of the fact, in spite of the fact that they said it would never happen, I won't do it because of the time issue. But care is being rationed. When you limit care or you won't give care to people over a certain age or for a certain condition, that ding, 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 that is rationing. And you can't keep healthcare affordable unless you ration. So, you know, that's what universal healthcare does, is so that everybody can be on a plan. And it failed because it's still not affordable. It goes up every year. But the difference is, the more we turn over, I thought big business and corporations that I worked for were flawed. And they are. But the government isn't the answer, because they're the last stop. When they get it, there isn't going to be any place else to go. And it's kind of like the one insurance company I talked to you about. It was better when we had competition out there, because that could help manage some of this a little bit better. But when it all goes to one system, they haven't demonstrated that they can keep the cost down and keep the quality of care where it used to be. You know, people are waiting so much longer to get into appointments. Certain things are covered, not covered. They add a deductible for everything every time you sneeze, every time you walk in the door, and then you've got your premium to pay on top of it. And so those will be things to consider in the future. But if you've got a kid playing, I tell you, if you buy the insurance, look at it before you make that decision. And before you buy the insurance, tell them you want to see. And I did this. It was funny. Years ago, you were mentioning different sports for girls. And we have a cheer, you know, that cheer that all the little girls sure. want to do that costs a million bucks. You know, that's right up there in your top three, girls getting hurt in cheer, little girls getting hurt in cheer. And we went with my husband's daughter, the grand girls, to like the first meeting of their cheer. And the girls were going to sign up with a clipboard, you know, the authorization form and the we want to do it form. And I said, do you have, I read a line that talked about insurance, but it was only one line. And I said, do you have a sample policy? You know, that was not a popular question. You know, the parents that were there, the kids that were there, you know, they really wanted to do this. And so, you know, I poured ice water, I guess, you know, on the group by saying, do you have a sample policy? And no, they wouldn't let me see a policy. And so, you know, all I could say to my stepdaughter at the time, years ago, is when you get that policy, read it.
Yeah.
So you know what to expect. And, you know, nobody ever really does that. But in any case, it wouldn't behoove them to be forthcoming because of the financial consideration. So, you know, you really do have to be your own best advocate. And that's why, you know, after we talked last night, I thought about the players. And, you know, I was talking to Ray last week and talking to different athletes when they were younger, that there was, you know, a lot of peer pressure to get back in the game.
Yeah.
Not only the kid wanting to, pressure to get back in. And I hope that we can at least re-educate you know, one of those values is that you're on the same team, which means you're subject to the same possible injuries. And so instead of egging a kid on to go back in after their bell's been rung, that could be you. And it could be something that might affect the rest of your life negatively. So if we could at least shift the kids that are going to play, get those safety protocols in there, and turn the bullying and peer pressure into one of those values that you were talking about, which to me means, isn't that one of the values that we're on the same team? We're teammates. Yep. It's a brotherhood or a sisterhood, and we've got each other's six. We don't gouge and pressure the person back into the game if they might be hurt.
One of the other things
because of
is
what
the,
you
the
said.
Yeah, the materials though that they hand out at all levels, NFL, NCAA, it's geared towards self-assessment. So really they're putting the onus of being your own brother's keeper. And I think that's really wrong because like in the NFL, these guys have contracts. They know if they don't play a week that some other guy that maybe makes less than them is going to step into their role and then they'll be gone, you know. And college, you know, there's pressure too. You don't want to lose your starting role or you don't want to not be able to play. You know, one of the things, because I've pondered this a lot, how do we fix this system? And, you know, sports has this unique exclusion that the team is not looked at like an employer. Because if they did, like me in a business right now, you know, my company, if I have an employee that I knowingly send into an area of risk and I don't have the proper OSHA gear for them or protective equipment, I get sued and I'm liable.
Yeah.
And yet for whatever reason, you know, that same methodology doesn't apply to the NFL. You know, if they get a guy that has a concussion, you know, they're allowed at their own discretion to determine when he can return back to play, you know, and, you know, they aren't telling these guys their long-term injuries and what that could do to them potentially. And then you get, you know, like myself 30 years down the road and, you know, you hear these horror stories every week on the media. Those are direct results of guys that had no idea that they were going through any sort of a change, you know, due to post-concussion syndrome or traumatic brain injury or what have you. And it's really sad. I don't mean to make it gender specific to just football. It's just what I know. But, you know, there's many other situations like that throughout sports, both men's and women's sports, that they're put in these incredible pressure positions as an athlete. And all we should really be able to do is just focus on playing and have other people that are there that are supposed to make sure we're safe do that part of the job. So.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I know you've got work in the morning again. Thank you so much for coming on. It's been a pleasure to meet you, Rico, and really
absolutely
appreciated on short notice that you'd come on the show tonight. And for the listeners,
anytime.
There's hope. There's hope. You're not alone. I want to thank Dr. Michael Weiland for being on the show earlier and hope that concussion therapeutic will come out to be people can get treated on the spot and hopefully not have to have it evolve over a period of years. And to your treatment, I hope that becomes readily available. And I know what you're saying, but if there's only one pharmaceutical or two out there, you know, there's a lot of drugs out there right now. We're not for concussion, but I mean, we're the most overprescribed country in the world for drugs. And a lot of the guests that I have on here are talking about holistic and treatments like what you just spoke about. So I think there's a place for both. What I'd like to see in healthcare is integrative healthcare where there's a combination of those things. And so I think if your doctor is talking in the right places, then word is going to spread, and because there's so little in the way of therapeutics out there right now, that is a win-win in that there's not, the worst that can happen is it wouldn't work for you, but it isn't going to give you something different, worse,
right.
a worse condition that right. we're aware of at this point. So anyway, thanks so much for coming on, and good night.
Thank
God
you,
bless, and we'll be in touch.
All right. Thank you. Good night.
Good night. Okay, everybody, I'm going to play a song out by the person who created Brain Injury Radio. Long as we're talking about Brain Injury Awareness Month, we want to be aware of the band THEE, the letter R, Insane. You can relate, right? TheRInsane.com. You'll find a lot of different music on there. If you like Brain Injury Radio, if you like music, go check out the hundreds of songs on TheRInsane. Maybe buy a couple for your personal playlist, and that helps us because Craig sponsors TBI Network/Craig sponsor Brain Injury Radio right now. And this is an appropriate song, Brain Injury Road. And I'll see you guys next week. Thanks so much. I'm sorry, that was not Brain Injury Road. This is, must be getting late. I'll see you next week.
Drugs being used, kids so confused, 'cause who out their whole life for the scene is a abused. We've got countries fighting countries, people killing people. When are we gonna stop and realize everybody's equal? I don't know. But as far as I can tell, the rich are getting rich while the poor are needing help. So dig right down deep inside of your soul to find the peace, love, and happiness to shine like gold in your mind. The best you can, and I know you can. Just sing with me now. I'm gonna keep on walking down my road till I'm tired and gray and old. Oh, oh, oh. I won't look back till I know. I do my best to help this. I know.